Welcome to Critical Land. I'm your host, Sylvia Cunningham. This is the second episode of an English language podcast from the Schirn Kunsthalle Frankfurt, debuting alongside its latest exhibition, Magnetic North, Imagining Canada in Painting, 1910 to 1940. In this podcast series, we're drawing from some of the themes in Magnetic North to go beyond what is displayed on the gallery walls through conversations with Indigenous artists and scholars. The exhibition examines modern Canadian landscape painting from a contemporary standpoint. It also features the film How a People Live from Anishinaabe filmmaker Lisa Jackson and Mobilize from Algonquin French artist Caroline Monet, whom you'll be hearing from in today's episode. Monet's immersive video installation, Transatlantic, is also on view in the publicly accessible rotunda at the Schirn. A quick note, we talked about the Group of Seven in the first episode of Critical Land with the exhibition's curator, Martina Weinhardt, and Lakota Scottish art professor, Carmen Robertson. So if you haven't listened to those interviews yet, you can do so at schirn.de/magazine. Now to today's episode. Caroline Monet is a multidisciplinary artist based in Montreal. She grew up in both Gatineau, Quebec and Brittany, France. Her mother is Algonquin, her father is French, and she works with many different mediums, including filmmaking, sculpture, installation, and painting. What you're hearing now is sound from Monet's short film, Mobilize, one of her works on view at the Schirn. The film has an incredible driving pace, from the music performed by Tanya Tagak to the actions we see on camera. There's one man masterfully paddling through the water, others are peeling birch bark to make a canoe. We also see scenes in the bustling city, including Mohawk iron workers climbing atop steel girders. I asked Caroline Monet how this film came to be.
So it's in 2015 that the National Film Board of Canada approached me to rework materials from their archives, and this was part of their souvenir series. So we were four filmmakers across Canada to make a three-minute video with their archives. And the only direction they gave us was to portray Indigenous identity, which I thought was a very abstract thing, because for me, there are many Indigenous realities. I had access to over 800 films. Most of them, of course, were made from a white male perspective, approaching Indigenous people from an anthropological standpoint, where the protagonists are always presented as very passive, kind of busy working on their craft and really insisting on remaining at the margins of Canadian society. So there's kind of a tension between the original footage that was created during a time of historical chaos and the treatment of Indigenous people and between the remix that I did in Mobilize. Because I use these visuals, these films, to kind of summon the mobilization of Indigenous people nationwide. And because for me, Indigenous identity is something vibrant and dynamic. It's not something passive that is shown in these films. Yeah, and I just wanted audiences to feel energized seeing Indigenous people showing off their skills on screen. So that's why I was particularly interested in images of people walking or building, canoeing, you know, just like moving forward. For me, this really counters the inertia too often portrayed in Canadian media.
Even the fact that you were invited to do this within the framework of Indigenous identity, which is this term that's singular, it's monolithic. How did you approach it? Did you approach it from your personal background, or how could you convey that it's impossible to boil this down to a monolithic view?
You cannot boil it down to a monolithic view because there's multiple realities of Indigenous identity, and there's so much diversity within the big Indigenous community itself across Canada. So, and I knew I didn't want to go into the nostalgic realm of choosing black and white footage. That's why I decided to go with 16 millimeter color footage, because to bring that kind of consistency from beginning to end of the film, and where audiences would almost feel that I shot it myself. So, and you start looking more at texture and colors and piecing each visual together, almost like a puzzle, except you don't know what the end image will be. You just piece it together and somehow start finding a narrative with all that. I think in some ways the film also represents my own family's history. I didn't grow up in my mom's community, but across generation it evolves on the land. And I think there's a level of privilege that comes with the migration to the city, of course, accessing jobs and education. But with that privilege also comes a level of assimilation and trauma and displacement. And you start building a new narrative in the city. So I was really intrigued by that and the kind of notion of labor that is very different in the city than it is on out on the land. It doesn't require exactly the same set of skill sets and knowledge. So the film was really about that. And overall, I think Mobilize is really about pointing how Indigenous people were instrumental in shaping Canadian society, I mean, to the extent of building skyscrapers in our cities. So it was about saying that our presence as Indigenous people can no longer be ignored.
You mentioned you narrowed down the scope to 16 millimeter color footage. How many hours of film was that then that you had access to work with?
I mean, I had access to 800 films, but you'd start typing keywords because you can't watch them all, obviously. And the keywords were really about building and walking and Indigenous people walking, Indigenous people running, Indigenous people building. And I wanted the idea of being in action and really not showcase a passive people. We're not stagnant in time. We're very active. And we have a set of skills that are, you know, very celebrated, actually. You know, we're part of this society, this vibrant society, and we have our place within it. And I wanted to show that. So you have to work quite instinctively with that process, working with archives. I mean, I was using also Tanya Tagak's soundtrack, which was instrumental in bringing that level of energy as well in the editing. I edited on the soundtrack. And her music has this traditional connection while remaining very contemporary, almost like metal music, which I thought was really interesting to use the archives to speak about the future. And her sounds helped bridge that, I thought, yeah.
Okay, so that came into the process. I was going to ask about that. That came into the process relatively early then. You knew that you were going to use Tanya Tagak's music and craft the footage to it to build and match that track's driving pace.
Yes, absolutely. I had access to her album and I chose the most upbeat track on the album because from the very beginning, it was clear to me that I wanted, because it's only a 3-minute, right? It was clear to me that I wanted to create an experience for audiences where they would be almost plugged to a computer and be bombarded by images, and then their heart would start pounding and they'd be out of breath and they'd be totally energized by seeing Indigenous people kicking ass on screen. And so you don't really understand what just happened to you, but you have this level of energy, and it's with Indigenous representation on screen, and that was the main intention behind the film.
And it's so mesmerizing and intriguing watching what everyone's doing. And there really is so much going on. In contrast, in a sense, to that is your other work that's being shown at the Sheeran in the publicly accessible Rotunda. And so that's your video installation Transatlantic, which is really devoid of human presence. For that work, which we're hearing a little bit of the audio from now, you embarked on a cargo ship from a port in Europe and then traveled to where you live now, to Montreal. Can you describe what that journey was like for you?
Well, Transatlantic is a trip I took in 2012 on a cargo ship from the Dutch port of IJmuiden, just west of Amsterdam, and all the way to Montreal, the Great Lakes in North America. It took me 22 days. To cross the Atlantic Ocean. And so the whole journey was documented through a mini DV handheld camera. And I guess the video carries different states of emotion that I felt at sea, like heavy tension, nervousness, boredom, and even sometimes a bit of fear when we hit storms, but also because I was in a male-dominated environment of shipping and industry. So there were moments where I did ask myself, like, why did I thought about doing this trip in the first place? But the initial idea behind it is that for me, the transatlantic ocean was a middle ground for both sides of my ancestors to meet. It was a very kind of symbolic place And this idea of borders, whether they're physical or metaphorical, it's always been very present in my work. So it was kind of a continuation of that idea. And I grew up between two continents and two cultures. So I've been fascinated with this idea of duality and how political and social histories, they shape your identity. And we always say that identity is intrinsic to territory, but what does it mean when you come from two distinctive territory? Well, you know, how does that shape your identity? So that was the kind of seed behind the project. But then as the project evolved, because I filmed it in 2012, so it took me, you know, a good 6 years to finish it. I finished it in 2018. And I'm glad it actually matured a little bit, because then the project started looking more into the Atlantic Ocean as a ongoing colonial movement and economic exchange between Europe and North America, and how colonization is a historical event defined by transatlantic slave trade and the genocide of indigenous people. So it became much more engaging piece rather than only a personal piece. Yeah.
What do you think it was in those six intervening years that allowed that framing and narrative to develop in your head? Was it a matter of research or other projects that influenced your reflections on it?
I guess it's just that I took the trip, and then the tapes were sitting on the shelf for a long time. I just didn't know what to do. I didn't have a clear idea of what to do with it. I knew I did not want it to be just a documentary piece. And that's why I removed all the men at work in the piece. It's very abstract. It becomes almost like a vessel traveling across a great divide. It's more of an experience rather than a document. And it was very important for me to create an immersive experience with it. And it took me this long. I'm not sure why some projects are, you know, Mobilize was done in only 1 month. From start to finish, from concept to delivery of the product, and Transatlantic took me 6 years. I think I needed some level of maturity as an artist and as a thinker to envision as some kind of an installation rather than just a document that would play at film festivals. Or I needed to evolve personally, I think.
What we see at the beginning of the film is this more industrial scene with smokestacks. And then at the end of this whole voyage, we see a cityscape at night with, you know, lots of buildings, of course. And I felt that those images are very anchoring because, you know, I know exactly where I am. And it's the in-between where it's just open waters, where you feel totally sucked in, where you feel like you can get lost. I'm wondering if that echoes a bit what it was like for you during your 3-week journey. You were quite isolated, right? I mean, what was it like being out on the open waters where, like you said, it was just interaction with the crew? There was no connection to the outside world at all during those 22 days, right?
No, nobody knew where I was, which was an interesting interesting concept. It's true, you have no connection to phone or internet, so you're really out at sea for 22 days, and it's kind of a pocket of time that is, you can't go anywhere. This is where you are, and very interesting experience. And all your references point, they all disappear because there's no point, no markers on the horizon. It's always the same, right? So you start getting into a different state of mind, I guess, which is a very intriguing place to be.
Something that my mom says, which I'm not totally sure I agree with, but something she says is that the best part of a trip is the part before. So the planning stage, looking forward to everything, the anticipation of the trip, and the afterwards, the memories of it and kind of reliving it. What were your emotions upon arriving home to Montreal the first night that you were back in your bed? Were you relieved, or was a part of you already romanticizing being back on the open waters? How did your return feel?
Yeah, I think there was a level of romanticizing the idea of crossing the Atlantic Ocean. It's the mythological route of, you know, my father coming to France and migrating to Canada, and so many other people, you know, so many generations and settlers experience. But yes, of course, I was ecstatic when I arrived in Montreal to finally step foot on land. because it's a long trip. You long for the people, for the connection to the people you love, obviously. So yeah, it was an interesting journey. But I'm not sure I agree with your mom on that one. I there's something very interesting with going from point A to point B, and the journey is what is fascinating. Actually, is how you grow as a person, and how the idea of crossing a line or something. The journey itself is interesting. Yeah.
Both of your works are being shown at the Schirn at the same time the Group of Seven's work is being displayed there for the first time in Germany, actually. How have you reflected on that context, especially knowing for visitors that they'll be presented with these different dimensions of art originating from people in Canada?
Well, definitely growing up in Canada, the Group of Seven is the kind of the first reference you have of painting and Canadian art in general. You really, every child in Canada has grown up on it. You know all the great painters like Rembrandt, Picasso, but you also know the Group of Seven. So we come to understand Canada through those paintings, and you come to understand the representation of Canadian landscape through those paintings, especially. But I guess my interpretation of it is that these paintings contributed of telling a story that is very different from the Indigenous perspective, because it was really about this pristine, uninhabited territories waiting to be discovered, you know, where and they call it the Terra Nullius, where it's in fact it was habited for centuries already, and to simply remove that Indigenous history from those stories, or to remove the Indigenous presence from that history, is perpetuating again the colonial gaze, the erasure of Indigenous stories and people, and the displacement of Indigenous people as well. So there's it's a bittersweet relationship with those paintings in that Group of Seven. Technically, they're spectacular, and it's a great movement. But at the same time, it contributes to exactly what we're fighting against.
Something we talked about in the first episode of Critical Land with Professor Carmen Robertson was the difference between land and landscape. What do those terms mean to you?
Well, landscape for me is a representation of topography, and it's something that is beautiful and that you can almost imagine as well. It's part of an imagination, and you can describe a landscape. Whereas land, for me, is where we belong. It's where everything originates. We cannot possess the earth. It's the earth that possesses us. We come from that, and we go back to that. I think the land is the notion of territory, and it's at the center of all people, because that's where all the roots of our knowledge is from, our languages, our traditions, our sense of belonging and sense of identity. So I think there's multiple territories and multiple land and Canadian landscape, and there's a diversity of it. And I think we can only speak of the land we come from. I don't think I could speak for Canadian land. I only know the place where I come from and the region I come from in Canada, and the connection that I have with that land in particular, and where my people have connection to that land as well.
I was watching a previous interview that you did, and I hope I'm understanding what you said correctly, but you were talking about how you're interested in Indigenous artists looking back and reflecting on various art movements. How would you apply your perspective to the Group of Seven's landscape paintings and the time in which they were painting in that movement?
Wow, that's a really good question. I don't know, because it's a movement in itself, but it would be how would you call that movement in painting? You know what I mean? Because it's quite figurative. So I'm not sure it's a movement that I would instinctively explore, such as modernism or Dadaism or surrealism, or, you know, where it becomes a real movement worldwide. This particular group is very particular to Canada and the representation of landscape. They're kind of explorers. on the land, right? They set out on the land and they tried to represent it to the best of their ability, but also adding their own settlers' gaze. So it's also a level of their own imagination that is embedded in the work. So I'm not, it's a really good question. I have to reflect on that one. How would I appropriate it from my own indigenous lens? Yeah.
You come from both Algonquin and French heritage, and I've seen how you've previously talked about marrying traditional practices with contemporary practices and that your work is often building bridges. Did you learn about your Algonquin ancestry and heritage through your own upbringing, or have you come to learn about this history and traditions as an artist who is specifically confronting these themes in your art?
Well, I would say as an artist, I was doing work that is research based, so it allowed me to go deeper into these notions and this knowledge, and learning more about where I come from. But it's something that was always present growing up. It's just not something you would talk around the kitchen table. You know what I mean? You don't really talk about your culture at home, or it's not something you start defining with your parents or with your siblings or aunts and uncles. It's more as an artist when I started looking into topics that are important to me and wanting to discuss certain things in our society, and wanting to open dialogue about certain issues of our society, then I started digging more and looking into more traditional art or traditional teachings, and just looking more into where my people come from. And like I said, I grew up in suburbia of Ottawa, so I didn't grow up in my mother's community. And I mean, we would go back for funerals or wedding, but it wasn't something that was super celebrated growing up. So it's only later that when it became a little bit more accepted also in Canadian society that I was able to dig a bit deeper.
Has that since become a bridge to your mother and extended family? I mean, has it become something you maybe would talk about around the kitchen table?
Yeah, maybe a little bit more, because now it's so embedded in my life and the work that I do and the research, part of the research that I do. So yes, of course, if my mom asks me, what are you working on, then I'll tell a little bit more about it, or just the people that I have in my surroundings. But I guess it's a way, you know, how can I put this? It almost took only four generations to, you know, with cultural genocide to erase us. And about not only 50 years ago, we weren't allowed to express ourselves creatively. So there's a certain level of responsibility that comes with the new generation and my generation to be able to be present and keep those traditions alive. There's kind of a gap, you know, between my grandfather and myself. And just to be able to work to bridge that gap and to bring that back into my own family and my own surrounding.
I'd love to touch on one more of your films, Creator Dada, and we'll add a link in our show notes so listeners can watch it after the interview. I was planning on describing it myself, but actually I'd love if you would describe it instead, what this short film is.
Creator Dada, well, it was the 100th anniversary of Dadaism, and I was asked by the Festival du Nouveau Cinéma in Montreal to create a carte blanche, so to make a very short video. And I had the white page complex. I didn't know what to do, so I decided to take the small budget they offered me and invite Indigenous Francophone women at my table and make a feast and buy champagne and treat them to a nice afternoon experience. And it's very rare that we get the chance to get together and just, you know, exchange and dialogue and spend time together. And these women are prominent leaders of their community. They're artists, and you know, it included Nadia Meyer, but also Alanis Abomsawin, who's, you know, this amazing role model for the Indigenous community. And I filmed the entire experience, and it was about breaking all rules because they don't suit us in Canadian society, and reinventing the world as we see fit. And it was about marching forward as women, as leaders of our communities.
And again, listeners should definitely watch this after the interview, because as you describe it, it is this gorgeous party and there's so much laughter and so much life. And I think especially right now, especially when dinner parties are basically a no-go during the pandemic, there is something especially entrancing about watching that. But we should note, you can't hear the original sound. You can't hear the conversation you're having. So begs the question what you were all talking about. And can you describe what the sound is, what we're hearing instead, and what made you not include the original sound?
Well, it felt like we needed to keep that secret. You know, we can't reveal everything. And because we were planning a revolution, we can't let everyone know about it, because then the plan doesn't work and everybody's going to know about it. So I guess it's interesting also because all this food is considered high-end food and gastronomy, but you know, most of it is very local traditional food as lobster, oysters. And I made this film after there was a big issue about Indigenous women in the media being abused by police officers in Abitibi region. And this film was a bit of response about countering, you know, the negative victimized image of Indigenous people or women, especially in the media. And women are still the most marginalized group of our Canadian society. So I wanted to show women as being eccentric, beautiful, exuberant, elegant, and raise them back to a level of on a pedestal, you know, to raise them back to a level of royalty. And that was the intention behind the film.
Touching on the pandemic briefly, I came across this quote recently from a musician that the pandemic is not a residency or an artist's retreat in response to external or maybe self-applied pressure to produce new work and be super creative in lockdown. How has it been for you?
I mean, it's been a good time in terms of slowing down a little bit, because as an artist, we're always in the stage of producing and presenting and representation. And to take the time to not travel as much and to reflect more on research and prepping for what's to come and reorient the work you're doing, it's been good. I was working on finishing a first feature film, which was good for me to take more of my time in post-production rather than rush it and move on to the next project. So I guess I took a little bit of break and never approached it as a time of creating, and didn't really slow down for me. I had to work differently, I would say.
That feature film that you mentioned, Bootlegger, which you co-wrote and which won Best Screenplay at the Cannes Film Festival in 2017, can you tell us a bit about where you are with it, also what it's about, and when we can see it?
Well, the film is in the final stages of post-production. So it's we shot it in 2019. December 2019, and we're just finishing it now. So hopefully we'll be able to release it a little bit later on this year, maybe this summer or next fall. But that's really, you know, now it's out of my hands as the production company and the rest of the people that are, you know, going to organize all that. But it's exciting to be able to make a first feature film, obviously. It's a bit nerve-wracking to be doing such a project in a time of pandemic, because we don't know how these films are going to end up, if we're going to have people in cinemas, if we're going to have film festival premieres. Is it going to end up online? And obviously, there's a little bit of disappointment because you work five years on a project to have it end up online and people watch it on their screens. But, you know, it's a different experience, and maybe it can reach more people this way. So there's you know, we adapt, and there's good and bad for everything.
And the musician Tanya Tagak, who provided music for Mobilize, will also be doing the music for Bootlegger, right?
Yes, exactly. So it's an ongoing collaboration. I was really happy Tanya Tagak accepted to do the music, and she worked in collaboration with Jean Martin, who she works with, or she collaborates with usually, and very happy with the way it turned out and the sounds that they created together.
How do you find that the music complements the plot and themes of Bootlegger?
Bootlegger is about self-determination and taking destiny in your own hands and breaking away from paternalistic laws. So the music is about, you know, connection to land, territory, wanting to break free. And Tanya Tagak has the perfect sound to it and energy for these things. It's this longing for self-determination. So I was really happy with this, was the merging of my visuals with that music.
Now, of course, you work on multiple projects at once. Do you find the ideas that you're working through in one piece will then kind of find their way into another, or do you keep everything very separate?
It's very ebb and flow. I mean, I don't plan anything in advance. I feel that each project leads to the next one. And my practice is quite instinctive also. It's about experimenting with the work, but also with myself, and hoping to evolve as an individual and making sure that the work evolves with each project. But working with different disciplines, it just keeps me on my toes, and it keeps me invested and interested. And also it keeps me outside of my comfort zone. And I think that's where I can grow as an artist and as a person, and I can learn. But I mean, the thematics and the issues and the way I approach each project is the same. You know, it's my level of interest is the same, and there's always a social engagement. And I think because I studied sociology, there's always a lot of social background to each project that I do, whether it's in sculptural form or in video form. It's always very present, that kind of sociology background. And it's also very research-based and very visual. I mean, even in filmmaking, there's not that many dialogues. I don't do too many words, I think. It's about creating an experience, an emotional experience with as little words as possible. It's a minimal approach, I think.
This year, you'll have your first solo exhibition at the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts. Can you share with us what you're working on for that?
Yes, the show will be titled Ningamene. It's a word in Anishinaabemowin, which means I give it to you, or it's the word we use for promise. And it's looking at the housing situation in Indigenous communities that has remained grievously unchanged over the years. In remote regions with harsh winters, construction material, they can be scarce and very expensive, and they're not very adapted to the environment there in the north, and there's a housing crisis. So I wanted to speak about that and the lack of vision from the Canadian government. I believe that, you know, we make our houses and our houses make us. So if we use cheap materials and if there's lingering moisture and that create molds, well, that definitely affects our mental, physical, and spiritual health. And so I think houses should be treated as living body. And the entire exhibition is about that, is using construction material with embedding traditional inspired designs. Yeah, and it's just about, you know, taking a look at how the federal housing system has been an agent in creating poverty in these communities, and what can we do, and offering like new, or hoping to open a dialogue about it.
And if we make our houses and our houses make us, how do you think your house makes you, and how do you make it? Do you think you apply that personally to how you build your home?
Yes, absolutely. I put a lot of care in my environment, and I really believe we affect the environment around us, and the environment affects us. And we always imagine the people representing the places they live in. But in the case of Indigenous northern communities, certain communities, I don't think that's true. I think there's a lack of resources to create proper homes. And this show wants to kind of break those preconceptions and break those negative stereotypes. In my case, right now my studio is quite busy, but usually it's pretty organized and clean. Every time I start a new project, I'll make sure that I do a cleanup and just to have that mental space, you know, to clear things up. And I don't like clutter, but that's me. I mean, other people are comfortable with that. I personally need some white walls and to be able to imagine other things. Yeah.
Caroline Monet, multidisciplinary artist whose works Mobilize and Transatlantic are on display at the Sheerne. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
You can find links to some of the films we mentioned in our show notes and at sheerne.de/magazine. We're also going to link to some of the artists Caroline Monet says inspire her. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. In the next episode of Critical Land, I'll be talking with Jocelyn Jo Strack, a scientist and member of the Champaign and Ajak First Nation in Canada, about the intersection of art and science and what she believes is missing from conversations about climate change. Be sure to follow the Sheerne's social media channels for more updates on that. I'm Sylvia Cunningham. Thanks for being here.